This is Melissa, and today is the 28th of July, 2024. I hope everybody's doing okay. Yesterday, on the 27th, we had book club, and Greg from Scotland led that. We covered a bit of Germany from Kaiser to Hitler. It was a good book club. We had an opportunity for us all to share, and for Greg too, how he got to be in the book club in the first place, and how, what Alan Watts' work has meant to us all. But we did decide that there was a lot to cover, so we're going to do Chapter 10 next Saturday, August 3, at the same time, 7 p.m. British time. So I hope some of you will be able to get over to the Telegram book club chat and join us for that. And we had a group consensus of one. Darren decided, and we all agreed immediately, that one chapter a month is plenty to read. And so in August, we are going to be reading Chapter 11, Changing Economic Patterns. So that is August reading. I had a busy and in some ways difficult week, and my poor Aunt Betty, who will be 95 in 2 weeks, is having some health issues. And I think what's going on is really going to turn out to be age-related, loss of hearing, vertigo, but we were 9 hours in the emergency room yesterday, ruling out major events like heart attack, stroke, and so forth. And I had just been with her 2 days before that to the doctor. And, you know, this is kind of a chronic, these dizzy spells for the last 2 months coming on. And so, you know, it's a process. So that took a lot of my time and emotions and attention. And I have a feeling that I'll be kept busy with helping Betty here and there with different things in the foreseeable future. So to tell you about this redux that I picked, I actually wanted to kind of get a head start. And so I picked the talk out, I think, last Monday and listened to it a couple of times early in the week. It is June 30, 2019. Just a minute. There's many an idea we've so sorely bought and pain foreseen with a little forethought. Now, if that little poem title sounds familiar to you, it does to me too. I swore that I had used it recently, but I scoured through all the talks to see had I put it up. I know that it was used a couple of years back as part of the Evil excerpt series clips, but there's no sign that it was a redux. So here it is, and the reason I chose it was politics, because that was on my mind last weekend, and I decided to just go for that and dig in a little bit more. What I was thinking about is, why do we vote? Why do we engage in this theater when we can see that the people we choose are psychopathic, narcissistic, we're participating in empire, global conquest, rape and pillage? That was on my mind. And then we had the opening ceremony of the Olympics in Paris. And so I kind of switched tack a little bit and gave that some thought. In April of 2019, the cathedral, the Notre Dame de Paris, had a major fire, and the spire and most of the roof was destroyed. And at that time, Alan said, I, you know, don't know how this fire started, but it symbolizes the end of Christianity, symbolically, to see a structure like that more or less be destroyed. I mean, not to the ground, but such major damage. So that was his comment. It symbolizes the end of Christianity. So by this point, a lot of you will know that we kicked off on Friday night in Paris to quite the spectacle, the 33rd Olympic ceremony. And you all saw different things. I wasn't watching it live, and so I had a kind of different response. I also was watching pieces of it before I heard some of the things that I would later see. So I'll just make a for instance here. I saw a horse take off, and behind it were two stationary wings that were lit up. And then the horse, the rider on the horse, had the what was the Olympic flag draped over her shoulders. So it kind of looked like wings. And the symbolism to me, immediately I said, ah, Pegasus, taking off from wings, continuing on with these wings. So that was my reaction. And a lot of people are saying that, oh, it was the pale, behold the pale horse. It was Revelation. This is one of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. What was clear was that there were a bunch of drag queens, let's say 13 of them, who represented Da Vinci's painting, The Last Supper. So this would be Jesus and his disciples, and they were all drag queens. And then there was the beheaded Marie Antoinette. So there are plenty of people that you can listen to who are going to go into good versus evil, light versus dark, God versus Satan. Elon Musk himself said this was extremely disrespectful to Christians. You think? It was pretty in your face, to say the very least. And on social media on Saturday morning, everyone around the world was weighing in on how this, what it was. It was covered by all the major outlets. The Satanic Olympics, boycott the Satanic Olympics. Of course, that didn't happen because they're still very well attended today, and they will be. Other commenters said, you know, the Olympic flag was hung upside down. I mean, it was hung upside down, and that would be symbolizing the fact that this would be the last Olympics we would see. I took a little time to think about that and to look and see for myself what I could, and I thought that the Marie Antoinette scene, in a way, you could think of these as little tableaus. You know, they're floating down this Seine. You've got actors and dancers and all kinds of things that the boats that carry the Olympians in are seeing. And the spectators trying to watch this, they light a red, white, and blue light smoke show. It's just quite the happening to... I even read that it was celebrating the city of Paris more than recent Olympics in recent memory had done. Just looking around at some of the things that were going on behind the scene that we didn't really see, they didn't have a camera crew on the fact that migrants and homeless people were cleared out of the city during the Olympics. There was also this... some kind of an attack on the train system, which slowed things down a bit. We don't know, as far as I know, who was behind these several different attacks. So it says, carrying backpacks and small children, hundreds of people sleeping on the streets of Paris climbed aboard buses surrounded by armed police on Thursday, the latest group of migrants and homeless people to be driven out of the city ahead of the opening ceremony of the 2024 Olympics. The group of largely African migrants headed for the fringes of the city in buses paid for by the French government and into temporary lodging until at least the end of the games. While some living on the streets were happy to have a roof over their head for the night, few knew what lay ahead once the world's eyes were off Paris. "It's like poker. I don't know where I will go or how much time I will stay," said one homeless Parisian named Nikki. French authorities have been clearing out migrant and homeless encampments for months leading up to the massive global sports event, which is an important moment for President Emmanuel Macron at a time of political turmoil. But the Games have also faced criticism as Parisians have complained about everything from elevated public transit fees to government spending on cleaning up the Seine River for swimming instead of investing in the social safety net. So anyone who has paid attention to France, even just at a glance for the past several years, will know that it's a bit of a mess. There have been ongoing protests about Macron's policies and total disregard for law. So it was not even 2 years ago that there were a series of protests where thousands of people went on a strike against the rising cost of living. So Macron's hasn't been particularly popular. France has been flooded with migrants for years. It's not a great situation there. So here's a little bit of reaction from yesterday to Friday night's opening. This is an American football player who is known to be religious and conservative, and he called it a crazy drag queen show and said, "God is not mocked." Kansas City Chiefs kicker Harrison Butker, who is open about his Christian values, was shocked by the 2024 Olympics opening ceremony, which featured drag queens recreating Jesus Christ's the Last Supper. "This is crazy," the pro football player, 29, wrote via his Instagram. He then quoted a Bible verse that read in parts, "Be not deceived, God is not mocked." But then he shared the full quote, taken from Galatians, "Be not deceived, God is not mocked. For what things a man shall sow, those also shall he reap. For he that soweth in his flesh, of the flesh also shall reap corruption. But he that soweth in the Spirit, of the Spirit shall reap life everlasting." Several people agreed with the NFL star, including Piers Morgan, who posted, "By the way, what the F was all that this about? A drag queen mockery of the Last Supper at the Olympics? Would they have mocked any other religion like this? Appalling decision." And I'll give Piers Morgan that. I don't think they would have mocked any other religion like that. A spokesperson for Paris 2024, which is what they're calling the 33rd Olympics, said clearly there was never an intention to show disrespect towards any religious group or belief. On the contrary, each of the tableaux in the Paris 2024 opening ceremony were intended to celebrate community and tolerance. The rep then explains that artistic director Thomas Jolly took inspiration from Leonardo da Vinci's famous painting of the Last Supper for the ceremony's festivities segment to, quote, create the setting. He is not the first artist to make a reference to what is a world-famous work of art, the spokesperson concludes. From Andy Warhol to The Simpsons, many have done it before him. However, this happens to be an iconic piece of art for many Christians. But I wanted to keep thinking about it, not just as an attack on Christianity, but what else did the symbolism mean? What did it mean to me? What was I seeing? And what I saw was a celebration of the French Revolution. And the French Revolution did include persecution of Christians, but it was revolution. So here we have this scene where Marie Antoinette is standing in this building. The building is the Conciergerie. This is the Revolutionary Era prison where Marie Antoinette was held for a time before being guillotined. This opening ceremony depiction of Marie Antoinette headless was used to illustrate, quote, the quest for liberty. And there is a rock band playing as the severed head chants. So you got that? The severed head is chanting, all will be well. And the band is playing a heavy metal version of Sa Ira, Sa Ira, all will be well. This was an anthem of the French Revolution. So let's look at Sa Ira. There was an original version that was first heard, I think, in 1790. It was said to have been inspired by Benjamin Franklin, who was very popular among the French people following his stay as a representative of the Continental Congress from 1776 to 1785. When asked about the American Revolutionary War, he would reply in somewhat broken French, Ça ira, ça ira. It will be fine. It'll be fine. So it became popular. It had some words which were revolutionary, but not completely insane. But at some point, later stages of the revolution, it took on more aggressive lyrics. This is called the sans-culottes version. The sans-culottes were basically the poor, the peasants. You might even say, like, including the homeless and migrants that just got bussed out of Paris. But the term sans-culottes means literally without pants. And that's because they were so poor they couldn't have those fancy pants, the little knee breeches. So this version I will read in English. Ah, it'll be fine, it'll be fine, it'll be fine. Aristocrats to the lamppost. Ah, it'll be fine, it'll be fine, it'll be fine. The aristocrats, we'll hang them. If we don't hang them, we'll break them. If we don't break them, we'll burn them. Ah, it'll be fine, it'll be fine, it'll be fine. Aristocrats to the lamppost. Ah, it'll be fine, it'll be fine, it'll be fine. The aristocrats will hang them. We shall have no more nobles nor priests. Ah, it'll be fine, it'll be fine, it'll be fine. Equality will reign everywhere. The Austrian slave shall follow him. Ah, it'll be fine, it'll be fine, it'll be fine. And their infernal clique shall go to hell. Ah, it'll be fine, it'll be fine, it'll be fine. Aristocrats to the lamppost. Ah, it'll be fine, it'll be fine, it'll be fine. The aristocrats, we'll hang them. And when we'll have hung them all, we'll stick a shovel up their arse. And there you go. That is what the French gave us for their opening ceremony. Not to mention that I learned from Andrea in the last real history that I did that an American artist by the name of Cleon Peterson had been commissioned to do a work of his creepy flat revolutionary figures at the base all around the Eiffel Tower. And this, as she pointed out to me in the very latest Real History, this artist has been heavily promoted by Edmund de Rothschild, and he actually painted a trimaran for Rothschild. So everything symbolizes something. This made me think about Trotsky's permanent revolution, where the revolutionary class just keeps it going in line with Marxist theory. It's never ending. So what I had intended at the beginning of the week, what I thought I would be talking about, would be why do we vote when Benjamin Netanyahu shows up in the American Congress to deliver his defense of Israel to the massive applause of American congressmen and women, as happened just a few days ago on Wednesday of this past week. Why do we vote? But sidetracked as I was and thinking about the revolutionary spirit, and remember, and the French Revolution really in some way has never ended. I think not. Because the same slogans and ideas that we saw there gave birth to some of the same slogans and ideas that we saw in the Bolshevik Revolution. And 2019, we start to see a different thing. And again, I said, Alan mentioned that Notre Dame de Cathedral burning in such a way symbolized the end to their mind. Let's phase it out. We're done here. Time for that new religion. And we've had Antifa and Black Lives Matter and just the steady drumbeat of more and more revolutionary unrest and all of the symbolism that goes with that. And so thinking about that, for some reason, the end of Christianity, it brought me back to Carl Jung because he had some interesting ideas. And Alan Watt has read several times from Jung, and in particular from his book, The Undiscovered Self, but other books as well, and mentioned him. And I go to The Undiscovered Self because there's a chapter there that is entitled The Position of West or the West on the Question of Religion. And what he's talking about, I don't know the year that this was written, but we're in the Cold War. We have a thing called the Iron Curtain. And where are we now? You know, who wasn't at the Olympics, as they haven't been anywhere for the past few years? Russia. So he is saying, is there a counter in the West to the ideology of the East? And he's specifically talking about this communist ideology. He said that the West lacked a uniform faith that could block the progress of a fanatical ideology. But as the father of Marxist philosophy, in other words, saying the West itself was the father of Marxist philosophy, it makes use of exactly the same spiritual assumptions, the same arguments and aims. Although the churches in the West enjoy full freedom, they are not less full or empty than in the East, yet they exercise no noticeable influence on the broad course of politics. The disadvantage of a creed as a public institution is that it serves two masters. On the one hand, it derives its existence from the relationship of man to God, and on the other, it owes a duty to the state. In other words, to the world, in which connection it can appeal to the saying, render unto Caesar, and various other admonitions in the New Testament. In early times, and until comparatively recently, there was therefore talk of powers ordained by God. Today this conception is antiquated. The churches stand for traditional and collective convictions, which in the case of many of their adherents are no longer based on their own inner experience, but on unreflecting belief, which is notoriously apt to disappear as soon as one begins thinking about it. The content of belief then comes into collision with knowledge, and it often turns out that the irrationality of the former is no match for the ratiocinations of the latter. Belief is no adequate substitute for inner experience, and where this is absent, even a strong faith, which came miraculously as a gift of grace, may depart equally miraculously. So he talks about creeds as being different from what you might call a true religion. A creed would be the dogma, the stated religion. And he makes an interesting point there, that when a creed is a public institution, it serves two masters, and the creed has no ability to affect political outcome. So what he's saying is that this moral infection from the East, we're talking about communism here, it needs to have an equally potent faith of a different, non-materialistic kind, and that the religious attitude grounded upon it would be the only effective defense against the danger of psychic infection. So he's making some distinctions here. You've got an inner experience which changes people, and you've got a creed, so you identify with this creed. But as he points out, and I concur, the creed and the profession, that I am, you know, nominally, I say I am a Christian, does that affect political outcome? I don't think so. There are our elected officials applauding Netanyahu, and this is just a recent example. Pick one. To say that you have a certain set of values that your nation lives by, that's just campaign rhetoric. What do we actually have in effect? I want to share just a little bit of his writing about the inner man, if you will, here. He's writing about consciousness. The structure and physiology of the brain furnish no explanation of the psychic process. The psyche has a peculiar nature which cannot be reduced to anything else. Like physiology, it represents a relatively self-contained field of experience to which we must attribute a quite special importance, because it holds within itself one of the two indispensable conditions for existence as such, namely the phenomenon of consciousness. Without consciousness, there would, practically speaking, be no world, for the world exists as such only in so far as it is consciously reflected and consciously expressed by a psyche. Consciousness is a precondition of being. Thus, the psyche is endowed with the dignity of a cosmic principle, which philosophically and in fact gives it a position co-equal with the principle of physical being. The carrier of this consciousness is the individual, who does not produce the psyche on his own volition, but is, on the contrary, preformed by it and nourished by the gradual awakening of consciousness during childhood. If the psyche must be granted an overriding empirical importance, so also must the individual, who is the only immediate manifestation of the psyche. The fact must be expressly emphasized for two reasons. Firstly, the individual psyche, just because of its individuality, is an exception to the statistical rule and is therefore robbed of one of its main characteristics when subjected to the leveling influence of statistical evaluation. Secondly, the churches grant it validity only insofar as it acknowledges their dogmas. In other words, when it surrenders to a collective category, In both cases, the will to individuality is regarded as egotistic obstinacy. Science devalues it as subjectivism, and the churches condemn it morally as heresy and spiritual pride. As to the latter charge, it should not be forgotten that unlike other religions, Christianity holds at its core a symbol which has for its content the individual way of life of a man, the Son of Man, and that it even regards this individuation process as the incarnation and revelation of God Himself. Hence, the development of the self acquires a significance whose full implications have hardly begun to be appreciated because too much attention to externals blocks the way to immediate inner experience. Were not the autonomy of the individual the secret longing of many people, this hard-pressed phenomenon would scarcely be able to survive the collective suppression, either morally or spiritually. To me, that is very important because he says a truth there. It should not be forgotten that unlike other religions, Christianity holds at its core a symbol which has for its content the individual way of life of a man. So if we ask ourselves, why was there so much persecution of Christians, priests, et cetera, during the French Revolution? Why, again, during the Bolshevik Revolution? Why are we living through this woke revolution where everything is upside down, where good is evil, or good is called evil? But at the same time that there is those truths, the creed itself and the dogma and the fact that there is the duty to the state that the church has, you know, you have so many 501c register, you know, they're tax exempt. Aside, today I was looking at something and I realized why I was targeted. I had my VPN on, which I know really offers me no privacy whatsoever. It's the only thing that's true about it is it's virtual. And I had it set to Dallas, and so it gave me some Dallas woman who was like a rah-rah, you know, Christian millionaire, and you too, and her father was a well-known pastor, millionaire, multimillionaire. And there was somebody else they were talking about, you know, some other Christian pastor worth, you know, $10 million. And there was nothing there in her rah-rah that I took a quick glance at that was talking about the inner man or woman or being changed or giving something back to society. It was like, you know, just God wants to prosper you. This is why I sometimes say, you know, what does it mean when you say that you're a Christian? What does that mean? You know, words, and I just mentioned this in The Real History, you know, Alan's own position on this, and his tenuous navigating in the world of the patriot slash Christian slash truther audience that would be so scandalized by some things that he would say. Sorry if I'm reading too much, but I wanted to close with this last bit of Jung. It's about a page and a half here. All mass movements, as one might expect, slip with the greatest ease down an inclined plane represented by large numbers. Where the many are, there is security. What the many believe must, of course, be true. What the many want must be worth striving for and necessary and therefore good. In the clamor of the many, there lies the power to snatch wish fulfillments by force. Sweetest of all, however, is that gentle and painless slipping back into the kingdom of childhood, into the paradise of parental care, into happy-go-luckiness and irresponsibility. All the thinking and looking after are done from the top. To all questions there is an answer, and for all needs the necessary provision is made. The infantile dream state of the mass man is so unrealistic that he never thinks to ask, who is paying for this paradise? The balancing of accounts is left to a higher political or social authority, which welcomes the task, for its power is thereby increased, and the more power it has, the weaker and more helpless the individual becomes. Wherever social conditions of this type develop on a large scale, the road to tyranny lies open, and the freedom of the individual turns into spiritual and physical slavery. Since every tyranny is ipso facto immoral and ruthless, it has much more freedom in the choice of its methods than an institution which still takes account of the individual. Should such an institution come into conflict with the organized state, it is soon made aware of the very real disadvantage of its morality, and therefore feels compelled to avail itself of the same methods as its opponent. In this way, the evil spreads almost of necessity, even when direct infection might be avoided. The danger of infection is greater where decisive importance is attached to large numbers and statistical values, as is everywhere the case in our Western world. The suffocating power of the masses is paraded before our eyes in one form or another every day in the newspapers, and the insignificance of the individual is rubbed into him so thoroughly that he loses all hope of making himself heard. The outworn ideals of liberté, égalité, fraternité help him not at all, as he can direct this appeal only to his executioners, the spokesmen of the masses. Resistance to the organized mass can be effected only by the man who is as well organized in his individuality as the mass itself. Those emphasized words are from Jung himself, and I'll read it once more for the heart of thinking. Resistance to the organized mass can be effected only by the man who is as well organized in his individuality as the mass itself. I fully realize that this proposition must sound well nigh unintelligible to the man of today. The helpful medieval view that man is a microcosm, a reflection of the great cosmos in miniature, has long since dropped away from him, although the very existence of his world-embracing and world-conditioning psyche might have taught him better. Not only is the image of the macrocosm imprinted upon him as a psychic being, but he also creates this image for himself on an ever-widening scale. He bears this cosmic correspondence within him by virtue of his reflecting consciousness on the one hand, and on the other, thanks to the hereditary archetypal nature of his instincts which bind him to his environment. But his instincts not only attach him to the microcosm, they also, in a sense, tear him apart, because his desires pull him in different directions. In this way, he falls into continual conflict with himself and only very rarely succeeds in giving his life an undivided goal, for which, as a rule, he must pay very dearly by repressing other sides of his nature. I'm going to skip a little bit. This is not to say that Christianity is finished. I am, on the contrary, convinced that it is not Christianity, but our conception and interpretation of it that has become antiquated in the face of the present world situation. The Christian symbol is a living thing that carries in itself the seeds of further development. It can go on developing. It depends only on us whether we can make up our minds to meditate again and more thoroughly on the Christian premises. This requires a very different attitude towards the individual, towards the microcosm of the self, from the one we have hitherto. nobody's going to supply that requirement for us but ourselves. You see, that very different attitude towards the individual, that's not coming from outside of us. So I've already said there's problems even saying the word Christian. What you're looking at when you're looking at these mockeries that are played out in front of our eyes, this is by no means the first, and it won't be the last. You know, Christian churches have been burned across France for the last few years, just like across Canada. Many, many Christian churches have been burned to the ground, a kind of protest. Where are the Christians who are outraged by Beyoncé wearing a kind of a Flag USA bathing suit kind of thing from which she's bursting out of as a celebration of the USA? Or Lady Gaga. I hope I'm getting the point across here. When your Christian churches are advertising the fact, they're celebrating their first transgender pastor, what is left to save? The work is the work of an individual, and the hope that we have is that enough people embrace their individuality. This is what always mattered to Alan, and this is where any kind of resistance to the system comes. We can be outraged all we want by the latest affront, but it won't be the last. Well, sorry I chatted on so long, and I apologize in advance that this will be going up late, but that is life for me lately. I hope that you're all doing well, and I'll be back to talk again at some point. So take care.
Hi folks, I'm Alan Watt, and this is Cutting Through Matrix on the 30th of June, 2019. It's astonishing how time is flying now, isn't it? And it is flying. It's not just me. I think everybody I know has said the same thing. It seems to be rushing in. And here you go, it's going to be July, and that will fly in too, no doubt. Before you know it, I'll be getting snow again in September, if I'm still here, that is. Again, that's global warming for you. We live in amazing times. We truly do live in amazing times. But before I get into anything tonight, and I had a whole stack of stuff I was going to give tonight, but I thought it's just repetition of what's in the main organized newspapers. With they've all got the same themes and memes and so on. Because everything today, as I say, this is a new chapter. News Now is simply part of the big agenda of sustainability, with all the different reasons they're giving you for sustainability, except the true reason, which is that they claim there's too many of you. And if you go in with all the sustainable methods they're going to push, and they are pushing through grants to small farmers to start little farms up, even sort of mud wattle type places and things like that for sustainability, you're going to find the health of the public is going to deteriorate very quickly. And when they cut energy out, turn off the energy, you won't have travel, you won't even go to hospital, etc. With paying all the different taxes for sustainability and carbon, etc., there won't be money even left for a lot of the hospitals, so the population will plummet. I used to wonder how they're going to effectively achieve their targets years ago when they came out with this. But then again, I had read the World Wildlife Fund's reports and all the different organizations that Prince Philip was the titular head of. And he was quite blatant about their goals and their agendas before they toned it down a bit or camouflaged it. It's always been about too many people. The whole global warming idea was dreamt up when they're looking for a reason to take over our rights to manage us all and have us give them up in a crisis scenario. And then you drum it up and drum up in a fever pitch, and then you have a new system, you're living in a new system before you know it, and you've lost pretty well all the rights that you had before. So this is a big, big change of the system that we're living in today. And there's no point complaining about it, really, because it's carved in stone. It's taught in every school and university across the planet now, as a fact. And they train the populations to go along with it. So the younger they are, the more they'll go along. They'll never question it. And that's how you rule the world, basically, a new system. But before I get into all that, I'm not going to very far at all, because I see you're just parting the stuff from the news, basically. Why bother? You can touch on it and just give a casual breakdown or something, but there's no point. There really isn't any point. Everybody who's anybody's bought off. If you're a politician, you got to go along with this stuff, or you won't get the financial backing. The big foundations and the top philanthropists on the planet are backing this. So there's nothing you can do. There's nothing to oppose this at all. And common sense won't do. Because, as I say, they've got to reduce the population of the planet. And it's not new. The idea is not new. It's a very old idea. And back in the late 1800s, in fact, the mid-1800s, some of the top early pushers for eugenics and control of the populations, etc., were very open about their ambitions to either sterilize people. And the best way to do, of course, is without their not just their permission, but their knowledge that's happening to them until it's done. Eh? And you can take that wherever you want to go with it. But it's also to do with what makes a healthy population. If you've got a healthy population where you can breed, for instance, you got to then cut out those things that make you healthy. So you reduce the type of food that people get for high nutrition, high protein, and so on. Substitute it with other things which aren't quite as good. Then you ration it eventually down the road. You ration it all. And that's where it's meant to go, for those who haven't caught on to the agenda. Before I get into it, as I say, you can remember to go into the website cuttingthroughmatrix.com. You can help me tick along here. You donate to me. You see how to do it at cuttingthroughmatrix.com. And remember, you can buy the books and discs I've got there too. And just straight donations as well. And you can use different methods of getting money to me. Because things are tightening up, there's no doubt about it. Remember, you can also, apart from all the usual ways, you can also use an international postal money order from your post office to send money. It's cheap. It's a lot cheaper than some ones that you send, other types. But international postal money orders from the post office, and you've got to use international to send to Canada if you're outside Canada. And it's internal for internal, of course, naturally. But as I say, it's cheap, it's effective, it doesn't take the big, big cuts at the top that other agencies use. And that can get some. You can also send cash. You're going to find things are changing drastically now. If you're not on board with the rah, rah, rah agenda, or if you even got questions about it, don't want your voice out there at all. What you do in a totally propagandized society is ensure there are no dissenting voices from the propaganda. And that's what's happening today, naturally. Buy the books and discs at cuttingthroughmatrix.com. And remember, all the other sites I've got listed there, the official sites, they're all mine. They're the only ones I have. They're all listed on that page, cuttingthroughthematrix.com. And you can order from them. Anything else outside is using my name and doesn't have one of those official sites. Someone else is conning you. So be very careful. Always go into cuttingthroughthematrix.com. You'll find the other sites all listed together on the com site. Take notice of them too, because things will change. They're changing quickly, as I say. Because I don't get much money at all. I never have, really. Most folk take you for granted, even ones that use you, the big corporations and so on, for media. They do that, actually. And some people even take the information out of the archives and use it for books. And they never send you a penny. Never, ever. And that's a society in which we live, of course, naturally. But for those who and it's only the decent folk really make you keep on putting out the stuff, because they're the few who will always help you out. Decent people. Everybody else today wants politics, basically. Politics I don't even bother with, because politics is a con game, and it's been a con game your entire life. And I've given talks on that years ago about the whole point of politics, which is basically to stop revolutions. If you didn't have politics, you couldn't vote out the scallywags after 4 or 5 years, you might have a revolution. So they give you the vote. You know, you vote somebody else in, and you're really voting the last bunch out. You're so sick of them. The same people you probably admired before you got them in. And then you go on this endless cycle of replacements, and most folk never catch on their entire life that nothing changes. There's agendas set in stone. You can hear them for 40 years, one party after another, but the same agendas continue. And that's your telling point right there. The same agendas continue. If you truly had different parties, you really would have different agendas. And I think it was Thomas Jefferson mentioned that too. When you see the continuity of agendas, even through changes in the House, meaning the Congress in the U.S., to different parties, when you see continuity of agendas, then know you're under tyranny. But we never catch on, do we? Because we're given these big, big, crisis things. You know, before it was global cooling, the coming ice age in the 1960s and 70s. Then they changed it to the global warming. We're all going to get fried. And then they went into climate change, which is just normal weather change. You know? And they can't lose that way. But anything that's, if you get a bit of rain today, it's going to be a major flood. If you get a bit of sun, oh my God, we're all going to fry. Like, we never had a really hot sun before. And it's just too easy. People will go with the media because it's what they watch on television all the time. All this propaganda. And it's repetition, repetition, repetition. They really can't remember very far back in their own lifetime to what happened a few summers ago or maybe a winter ago or whatever. They really can't remember. And even if they think they do, it can be overridden, like Aldous Huxley talked about the suggestibility of most people. It can be overridden with a little bit more persuasion, and they'll ignore their own sensibilities and take the expert's opinion on something. He gave a good talk on that at Berkeley. Part of it, well, it wasn't all about that, but he did say that most people were suggestible. And I think he said about 40% to 60% of the public were all instantly suggestible with different advertisers knew this. That's why it worked so well on television, for instance. And he said, but he says, if you take the instance of a snake oil salesman selling you something that's going to be a cure-all for everything, and that the 40% the frightened people will buy it right away. They'll have a relief from it because there's nothing wrong with them in their first place. But they're very suggestible. But then 20% will phone up and say, well, it didn't work with us. And he says, with more persuasion, that 20% could be won over and you'll believe it too. But they need a bit more reinforcement and persuasion. And then another 20%, he says, really had to have high. So altogether, you have to put 80%. Can be persuaded into accepting the propaganda eventually. 40 easy, 60 with more, and then up to 80 with extra, extra, extra. It's also about 10 to 20% in the public, you said, that back in the 60s, you said, you just can't bring them under. They're not suggestible enough. I would differ today with that. I think today it's much easier to bring people under. The techniques are far superior to bring folk under to accept what they're being told, and they'll accept it even if their own observations are contrary on whatever topic it is they're changing their minds on. So it's quite something to live through a time when neuroscience is rather open in some areas about the studies that they've done on us and tests they've done on us. They're constantly doing tests on all of us. And again, that's a whole different topic again, and I've given talks on that over the years, but it hasn't stopped, and it's getting easier. Once you get into the accepting mode of what you're being told, it's far easier for you to swallow the next lot of drivel that comes your way. And they know that at the top as well. There are many reasons for it too. And one of the reasons, of course, is most folk don't want to stand out from their peer group. And again, the studies and all that are just astonishing, where they find out the most adaptable and unquestioning people accept something new, and they'll push something new, are the cocktail crew, the meet for the stand and have drinky poos, and they discuss the latest books, the best authors, and chat like that. The middle class type. And even in the civil service in different countries, that they're very prone to it. And they don't want to, no one wants to be different in the civil, you want to be accepted. Accepted, that's how you get promotion. You don't cause waves, and you don't say something too outstanding. That's when you shock people around you. They might be frightened because you're clever, and you won't get very far that way in those areas. So anyway, you find that they want to be accepted by their peer group. And they've got to all conform to what's being pushed, you see, by experts and scientists, etc. It's quite amazing to watch it happen. But most folk do conform very quickly. Children do too. They don't want to be left out of their peer group or pointed to, because children are very cruel to each other. And they'll have fights and everything else. They're nasty if someone is a bit different to the crowd. And that can be used by, let's be honest here, the teaching fraternity, who are on board with their indoctrination agendas, because they're really change agents, as some previous authors have talked about who are dead now. I think Charlotte Isaby was one of them, who went through the educational system in the US. And she was up there on the board for education for the U.S. government, I think under Reagan, maybe. And she went through how they started changing it for indoctrination, until she called them the teachers' change agents. Well, they're well paid for behavioral changes. That's their main thing today. It's not so much education and things to help them throughout their lives. Children, therefore, can be persuaded to adapt with the threat of being ostracized from the group by teachers who have read their tool books, they call them toolboxes, how to make sure that all the children come out of that class and that, with that topic, with all the same opinion on the topic, you see, the desired opinion. Remember, in education, that uniformity is awfully important. That's how you get your degrees, etc., if you conform to what they expect. They're not looking for brilliant people. And if you are brilliant, you may have trouble, and you may have to keep your head down. It's sad, but true. Sometimes you need a bit of entertainment. In this day and age, you see, to learn something. And everybody's taught that anything you learn, even very serious topics, it's easier to put some humor into it, you see. You've got to be entertained with everything today. And it's a shame, because if you had straight, real, honest news, you would need an entertainment. But you don't really get straight stuff today. You get well-known people to present stuff to you on television. And of course, you know they'd never lie to you. You know that, don't you? They'd never lie to you. They're there to help you. Isn't that, they're an appendage to your brain. That's what Zygmunt Brzezinski said, basically, in his book Between Two Ages, that the media really would become expected to be, in fact, he said, surely the media will be expected to be an appendage to their brain, basically, by the general public, because they were being trained then that they would do your thinking for you. It's what he said in his own book, basically. Paraphrase it, that's what he said. And it's all happened. We know that it's all happened, and we're living through it. And most folk don't know it. Most folk really don't know it. But they still fall for the famous faces thing. The people who get big, big money as anchor people that you're used to, because they'd never lie to you, would they? Now, I do remember a time where they used to at least have the decency to give you opposing views on television, on news and debates and so on. The object wasn't necessarily to completely demolish an opponent's opinion in a nasty way. It was to give them both points of view and some kind of rational, detailed description to the general public, and let the general public make up their mind. Well, that's long, long gone years and years ago, that whole way of doing things. Today you're told what you're supposed to think, and you're really ridiculed as a little child if you're stubborn and you don't go along with it. That's where we are. We don't have tolerance today at all, as we know, because you're being trained to be a perpetual child. And experts run the world. That's true socialism for those who don't know it. And you should go and study socialism. Go and study the early authors, some of the earlier authors of socialism, who made it quite plain what they were talking about. Read Man and Superman, for instance, and George Bernard Shaw, and you'll have them tell you that when they're in charge of everything, in true socialist form, scientific socialism, as they call it, those who are deemed more intelligent would run the world. They would be picked out to rule over the rest of the public, and they would make the decisions for the public. The proper scientific society would be created by these experts, and you would do what you were told. You'd be obedient, and you'd serve the system. Because in reality, you see, we're going into a completely intolerant system. You're seeing it today, as they say, if you don't go along with the status quo, with the laws that have been carved in stone, kind of like the laws of Moses. I mean, Moses wasn't appreciated here by his people when he came down from the mountain with the laws from God, you see. And the people say, "You're kidding, we don't want them." And Moses lost his temper, and he threw them down and smashed the stones. So he was the first person to break the law. And look, he was elevated as a hero eventually. But anyway, getting back to the point here, when you think about the world in which we live now, Bernard Shaw made quite plain, and we saw it in action through the old Bolshevik and into communist era of the Soviet bloc countries, and then in China too, but the Soviet bloc countries, where they set up the Politburo organizations and different strata of bureaucrats who ran everything, and different levels and tiers, etc. And that was it. You did what you were told. You were told what to think, what to say, what to do, or else. And you were monitored incredibly well, detailed. They had all this files and files and files on everybody. They didn't have the computers back then to keep tabs of it, but they had detailed filing systems. The Stasi in East Germany is astonishing about the system that they had and the files they had on everybody. Well, now they're of course the same systems using the internet and all your data and your cell phone data and all that kind of stuff until you can't utter a word without them knowing about it. And they can replay that years later if they want to. And they will. They'll say, "Did you say that?" Back in the year so-and-so, and you'll say, "No, I don't think so." Well, they'll play it for you and say, "Oh my, well, I guess I did." And that's you guilty right there, you see. The context doesn't matter. Nothing matters as long as they get you saying it. And that's where it's all meant to go. See, people don't think about what they're reading today and what's the real intent of it. The intent of most of the stories you're getting today is to train you of what's to come. That's what it is. And I can remember years and years ago when a judge would get in trouble for throwing a case out of court, for instance, in Britain and elsewhere, but mainly it was Britain at the time, because no one really had much respect for the big judges in Britain except the legal profession themselves. And there was so much weirdness within the judge, that kind of position, or the folk who went into it, that's for sure. You find that occasionally they throw some out of court. And once in a while, even today, down in Argentina or Brazil or something, you'll see similar things happening occasionally where a woman is going to take someone to court because she went out and had a date and got drunk, went back, took her clothes off and slept with a guy, then claims that he had sex with her against her will. And the judge would say, well, why on earth would you get drunk in the first place with a stranger, go to their place, take all your clothes off, and then go into their bed? I mean, you understand that that's what the judges would say years ago, more so. Today they're terrified to say something like that because everything's politicized. Everything today is politicized, really. to an extent is dangerous. But what it's training you for, it's nothing to do with sex. What it's training you for is for years down the road, when the big world system pulls out of the thin air something you said on the phone or whatever 30, 40 years ago. You see it happening in the government today. I listened to the Democratic Party on the radio in the US, all vying all with their Christmas giveaways, because every day with them is Christmas. You know, they're going to give you, everything's going to be utopia and wonderful and free. And each one's trying to outdo what the last person's promising the people. It's astonishing to listen to it. But I thought of the same kind of thing happening there, because some of them complain about the other delegates on the same party who supposedly were against or against the busing problem. I'm quite sure for or against the busing problem in the schools years ago. And so they're trying to get a big deal about that. So in other words, what I'm saying is anything from 40, 50 years ago can get pulled up any time. And they'll use that like a battering ram against you. The context of the time has got nothing to do with it, that they'll say, and things like that. That's how you can be lambasted. But you're getting trained for what's to come, because everybody is going to be under this world Stasi system. We're in it actually already. Of course, we all know that, but I think we all know that. It's going to get worse and worse for the controlled socialistic, controlled society. I don't see any real parties, political parties out there of any wing, as they call themselves, wings, left wing and right wing, that are against this system. And I really haven't seen any demands, like full, absolute clenched fist demands that big tech backs off of collecting the data on everybody. It hasn't happened. It's not going to happen. Because that is the agenda, folks. That really is the agenda. And you constantly with other things that you hear and read about and so on, it's all to do with training you for what's to come down the road. Absolutely. I gave talks years ago about self-policing. Now, self-policing is a term the United Nations has used for maybe 20, 30 years with some of their agendas for a world society, where they would train the people to self-police their thoughts and what they say. Well, you're going through it all and you don't even realize that's what's happening. You don't know. When they say things and have big world meetings about it and they reinforce every part of their agenda and update it all the time and publish it, they're not playing themselves. I mean, they are that too, because they love to have big salaries and have meetings and look important. But the fact is, they really mean what they say. This agenda is fixed in stone, as they say. And there's no Moses to break it, you see. It's fixed in stone. There's no opposition to it. Isn't it astonishing how easily, under the guise of keeping you safe, and it hasn't kept anybody safe, but keeping you safe, all your rights have been taken away from you, all the rights of privacy, that anybody in Europe, even in the Middle Ages, realized where it was vital to have privacy and security. In ages where governments, which are generally royalty or monarchy at the time, with their armies, could just plunder in your home anytime they wanted to, and they did. And folk fought to keep privacy. And now they've given it all away, because your government's going to keep you safe. I was thinking too about the lead up to the 20th century, and how blithely and easily we toss out the warnings from great minds going down through the past, who always acted as people almost like prophets in a sense, but just big, telling you to be wary of it. Hey, think about this. Think about it. Don't just rush ahead. Think about it. And we've forgotten all that. We've been rushed. I gave talks years ago of how the neuroscientists and psychologists and behaviorists knew that once they can stampede the public with fear and terror, oh my God, the world's going to end with an ice storm eventually. Oh no, let's change that to global warming. Oh no, let's change it to climate change. Etc. We're running out of food. Oh my God, yeah, we're running out of food. Yada, 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 yada. And terrorism, terrorism everywhere, and give up all your rights and to keep you safe. It's just one thing after another, isn't it? You don't get a minute's peace to breathe. And if you breathe, they're trying to stop you breathing and pollute the atmosphere, you know, with that CO2. I mean, you don't really have any peace at all. And they've got fanatical armies set up to parrot this stuff for repetition, like Bertrand Russell says. Repetition, constant repetition, the same little slogans. And that's how you do it. When you get brainwashed with these repetitive slogans, you don't have to add details or give them facts on anything, just the little short sentences, you know. Climate change, see? And the folk are stampeded. And when you get them stampeded, you got them panicked. Well, the whole technique today is don't give them any peace to regain their sensibilities and take a deep breath. Keep them panicked, keep them stampeded, and you can ram change after change after change along the agenda in quick succession. And that's what you're living through today. And all the old prophets of old did warn us about all of this, and they did tell us. And we see it even with when the first 1,000 years AD came up, that all these portents, oh my God, of things were going to happen, because there's a magical significance to time and numbers, of course. They talked about comets being seen and portents of terrible things, etc., etc. And they also had a real deep knowledge of forces, including evil, in religion. And anyone who discounts evil is going to end up either watching or participating or being a recipient of horror. That's a fact. For all the lessons we get taught, we so quickly throw it out the window and let the experts again rush us and stampede us onto the next part of the agenda. Never forget the horror. And when the second millennium came up, basically, or when they came up towards the year 2000, you know, even before that, we came up, the crescendo build-up in the 19th century into the 20th century. Really think about it. The build-up to that, the latter part, going up to the second millennium, but not at it yet, but the latter part, was a horror show of World War One. And never mind all the wars across the world, with occupations and empires, etc. But with the rise of mechanisms and science for weaponry, you led up to a horror show. And Nietzsche, of course, they always give you, when they take away your religions, they give you philosophers as though they're gods in their place, you see. You had quite a few, of course, trying to, and Nietzsche was brought out, God is dead, basically, you see. And the whole idea was, well, if God's dead, then all the values, all the little safety mechanisms that could hold us back from being utter massive slaughterers, that was taken away, and yet the curtain was opened and you could peek through and say, my God, there's nothing to stop us to do whatever we want to do now. If there's no God with rules and laws and regulations, then all the unthinkable becomes thinkable. All the unthinkables, all the horrors which were unthinkable now, they're possible because there's nothing to stop you. And you're throwing away the last vestige of human morality. And then now you can say, oh, well, our scientists and our social thinkers can now rule the show, and they're the real gods, because if God is displaced and tossed away, who is the new God? What's a scientist, you say? And it's a social philosopher. And it's a dictator. And here you are. And so you had World War One, where millions of people were thrown at each other across muddy battlefields for years. And the gross domestic product of the entire planet, of what they call the civilized world, went in to try to blow each other up. And that was the peak of your civilization and your knowledge. And suddenly you're given the sciences and abilities to put things together and to create your weapons and technology. And you call this civilized. And again, behind it, you had this group, cabal of revolutionaries who'd worked for centuries before that to build up a world revolutionary force for total world conquest, to bring the whole world under their dominion. Because, you know, unlike Nietzsche, they'd tossed God out long, long before him. And they foresaw what they could do with nothing to hold them. And they were given their wish. And then, of course, you had World War II that came out of World War I, really. And then you had, it culminated with atomic warfare on Japan and the threat of countries elsewhere afterwards for years. And we say we're civilized now. Civilized. When 9/11 happened, you know, the emergency call number happened, 9/11. We all know that, 2001, right? And I got to admit it, you know, that whenever a big thing is done, you only have incredible symbology and numbers thrown at you. You're supposed to swallow calmly and say, oh, that's a coincidence. But anyway, when it happened, after the PNAC group talked about the need for a Pearl Harbor event, to mobilize the public opinion on their support for the wars they'd planned, or they'd like to do, you see. And they got their wish. They're so lucky that way, aren't they? Another coincidence. But anyway, immediately, Afghanistan was attacked. They already had troops built up to it before 9/11 happened, yeah, to go in. It was in all the papers. See, I did shows at the time talking about it from the newspapers at the time, and I always use what's given as facts, what's given, whether they are facts or not, but they're given as facts by news. And so I didn't conjure things up out of thin air. And they did, it was a Canadian paper at the time, but they said that the US think tanks that they really were pushing, creating the propaganda for this big war, you see, had changed its sights very quietly after going to Afghanistan. Quietly changed them all the way to focus on Saddam Hussein in Iraq. Without the people being even aware that it happened, it just seemed to be, it's like George Orwell, who we find today, East Asia, West Asia, who is it? Eurasia. You just keep changing your sights and the folk just follow on, you see. And then Bush, George Bush at the time, who was the president, an inquiry, I'm sure it's still out there, he said, when he was asked at the choir about why they went into Iraq, you know, he says, well, I didn't say that Hussein had anything to do with 9/11. He says, he was a bad man. We're better off without him. So it's okay to do that. But before they did that too, they starved the people for years with embargoes. Huh? Probably, they made it over 500,000 at one point on television. Madeleine Albright talking. And she was said it was worth it, starving them all. 500,000. And by the time they were finished, it was about 1,000,000. Of starvation, malnourished, lack of medications and so on, medicines. What I'm saying here is, do you really think we're progressing to some better future here? Huh? What makes you think you're somehow civilized now? When they're doing the same thing today with Iran. And the US and other countries have been, got special forces into Syria for years trying to topple them. Because just like they don't like the president of Venezuela, who was elected, they don't like the presidents of other countries who are elected as well in the Middle East, like Syria. Where they toppled even the president of Egypt at one point, the prime minister. Because they thought he wasn't secular enough. The West thought that. Well, so much for non-interference and so much for this thing called democracy, eh? Think about it. But we're civilized, aren't we? We're civilized. We don't go and just blow them up all the time. We starve them to death. Have you seen folk being starved to death, folks? How come the wonderful news organizations aren't telling you all about that? How come, eh? How come? Isn't that news? I remember years ago they had photographers who put exhibitions on in New York and other places, because they go around places in Bangladesh and in Africa, other places, India, Africa, all these countries, third world countries, where often, mind you, it wasn't just because, and again, you have this drum beat in the back, there's too many people, too many. No, you always had Western interference for corporations wanting resources in these countries and causing civil wars all over the place. Standard technique. And when you have the civil wars, no one's doing the farming. Huh? And the food supplies can't get made and kept up. And the ones that are given to them can't even get through. I can remember stuff with Red Cross parcels ending up going through the Sahara Desert years ago on camels. To be sold elsewhere by tribesmen. But getting back to the photographer, and he had all these professionally done photographs, and he had some video too of going in to these designated areas where there had been mass starvation. And what do you think you'd hear? It's not like you're seeing on a give you for news today, or you see the kids screaming and yelling, give me, you know, and the hands waving and they're all. What you've got is a deathly silence. That's what you get as you go in. And you've got children, and you see children dead and dying outside in the streets next to houses. Mother is the same thing. Often the mothers would die first, trying to give the last vestige to the children of food. And so the children were lying. They have no energy to move, to crawl, whatever. The dogs and animals are all gone, you know. Either been eaten or they've starved themselves. But this deathly eerie silence everywhere. And that's how you go out, not with a bang, but with a whimper, as it says. And we think nothing of it when you're told they've got embargoes against countries which they don't agree with. Now, I don't blame nations. I don't believe these. What's a nation? Have you ever had a say, like a vote on anything, any particular topic that actually mattered to you anywhere? You don't get it. These actors are put in as political parties and so on, and they go along with the standard agendas. And then you wonder what on earth they're up to when they make all these strange rules, laws, and so on. So you get no rights at all. And how even the pretenses of rights today. And you still vote for them because you'll vote them back in again. Look at Europe. Europe's a bit demolished right now. Because like every other country, they're importing stuff from the third world that's manufactured abroad. The top corporations that were based in their own countries own them in China with the cheap labour. But nothing's made back pretty well back in your own countries. So why you call it your country for, or your corporate, or Britain has decided, or Canada's decided? What are they talking about? Were you asked to vote on? No, of course you're not. Or the wars that come up. And again, at one time, folks just scratch their head, at least scratch their head and say, what on earth are we doing over there? You don't even get that now, do you? Because you've been trained as all out of your hands. Again, back to Man and Superman and George Bernard Shaw. You know, they would rule the world, all these experts. You just shut up and behave yourself and go and play. and you'd be a good citizen. That's what you're told. But the folk never catch on that because they're too well trained. And I said this years ago. I said, you get 20 years off the internet and then they'll reel it all in and then it'll be a curse to you because it's just nothing more than pigeonholing you, constantly pigeonholing everything you do, your personality even changes, until if you change in your routine, you'll get a knock on the door by the world's special police force or something to find out why you haven't continued with your usual routines. I'm not kidding you at all. It's astonishing how folk are adapted to this, but yeah, death, it's okay for us to sit by and be proud of our nations as they starve other countries. This could be you getting starved to death. What say do you have in your country for what leaders are doing? But it's okay to starve folk in another country who are just the same way, have no say in their own country about what their leaders are doing either, eh? You're dealing with massive political power plays by the most important people on the planet, wherever you look, corporate or otherwise, who want resources, who want these countries' resources, or who want their land, or who want to rule them, basically, straight out, they want to rule them. That's what you're seeing. And any excuse will do for corporations. I gave that talk years ago where an awfully good documentary was put out in Britain. And it's when Sierra Leone had a so-called civil war going on. And Sierra Leone had diamonds, of course, and gold, etc. But the documentary from Britain, I believe it was very open. At one time they did some good documentaries. And they showed you the British mercenaries that were over there, basically managing the troops, ordering the troops around and so on. The native troops in Sierra Leone, and had native troops here too. And the British troops and the mercenaries were managing them, directing them like officers, basically. And then they flashed it to a big, massive tower in London, a big business tower, where a corporation, international corporation in diamonds and gold, had its offices. And they talked to, I guess it was a CEO or a managing director of this company, who'd helped finance the mercenaries and even finance the weaponization, they brought in the arms, etc., for the mercenaries to train the locals and get the wars going. Because what had happened is their own people had put in their own leaders who wanted to have rights over their own country and their resources and their diamonds and gold and so on. So this company in London said, come on, he says, I don't even have a proper government. He was quite candid, the fellow. And he's laughing when he's asked, why are they in there meddling with this country's affair? He says, look at that. Look what they're sitting on, he says. Look what they're sitting on. He says, and they don't even know it or use it or even bother to exploit it. And he talked back to the reporter, as though he wasn't offended. He just felt that you can't be serious, that you ask me why we're in there. You know, to him it's quite logical. That's what you do. And I'd rather have that. I'd rather have someone honest about it, why they're going in and plundering a country, rather than this political hoopla that's for the same thing. Look at the talks I gave about Tony Blair when he was in. The one-man band to wave his hands to get Britain into the war against Iraq as well. That's what nobody else wanted it. He was bought and paid for, and you know who afterwards, was his paymaster afterwards when he left it. Who did he go and work for? J.P. Morgan. And what was he put in charge of afterwards? What did he put in charge of the quartet, they called it? Managing Middle Eastern affairs for the corporations and oil and gas industries. That's what Evan's about. But he also, it was in the newspapers, and I always gave the links to things and the actual stories. It was admitted that before the war in Iraq started, he and some of the top oil corporate executives met together and divvied up Iraq before we even invaded them. This is reality, folks. So never fall for they're just bad people. I don't care who they're talking about. They're just bad people. These are ordinary people like you or I across the planet who generally don't want very much and who've got as much say in their own countries as we do, which is nil. And you've got these corporations using national armies across the planet to fight their wars for them, to plunder. It's disgusting. But no, I can't look at a guy again from the 20th century, right? There's 2000 years. Almost 2000 years. Then you get into the millennium. 2000, it really started in 2001 and 9/11 came along. Boom. There you go. And we've used cluster bombs since then. We've used what they call the bunker busting bombs, which literally can shatter the size of a mountain. And they really are tactical small nukes. That's what they are. And we haven't even touched on biowarfare laboratories across the world. We're just looking at how we use conventional stuff, you know, conventional ways of slaughtering or starving or whatever people to death. What would you do? Think about it. Let's reverse it. If your country gets so broke as it gets plundered, at a time when you've never had a minority of people getting richer and richer and richer, an even smaller minority getting richer than any pharaoh could ever dream of in ancient times to the present. As they tell you, you're democratic. And then you're stuck with a bill for all as they get the profit, which is what happens now. And supposing some country says, well, you know, we won't be happy till you get your government out of office. Then they start embargoing you till you're starving to death. Think about it, folks. Never mind this global agenda when they've conquered the planet and everybody on it under sustainability and start reducing the population by taking away energy and all types of food from you, etc., etc., and sicknesses return, etc., etc. That's all part of sustainability, folks. People aren't living longer today because they're living in mud and wattle and stick huts. And once you put them back in it, and by the way, there's some articles that have really tried this in sustainability programs in places like Wales under a novel little thing that they call Hobbit houses. It sounds wonderful and quaint, but I know where it's all meant to go, folks. And most folk don't, they don't. They fall for the propaganda, especially the children who've had early conditioning into the whole agenda. So what I say is, think about it. Think about it. We haven't got nicer going up to the year 2000. Before that, as I say, you had the 20th century of mass slaughter like never before. Where your whole GDP was put into armaments to slaughter and blow things up. And people and blood and bones. To blow it all up. And to burn it and scorch it. And we think we're civilized. Now we try to do it quietly if possible by starving folk to death. Because the leaders that they have no control over are supposed to get out of office because the West or some other country wants them out. Or their neighbours or whoever it happens to be. And just like always, the US had the right idea when it started. No foreign entanglements, no treaties, you see. And they forgot that quick enough, didn't they? And then, of course, President Wilson managed to get them into World War I with Bernays, who boasted about it afterwards, using the biggest marketing company to put out propaganda to get them into World War I. He boasted, he put a book out about how they did it, how they conned the American people. And since then, the US has been involved in war after war after war. And once that happens, corporations are ruling you quite easily. So anyway, yeah, mass slaughter was what we've done in the past. they had meetings in Britain while World War II was going on, and it was held under the King's auspices, supposedly, an international meeting for the countries that could attend it, talking about that they'd have to go further because the war wasn't killing enough people off. And World War I hadn't done enough either. See, they talked about ways to reduce the population of Europe and Britain. And then they went to it. And it's up to you how you want to guess how it's been done. But believe you me, it's always done under the auspices. We're here to help you. That's the easiest way to do it, always, isn't it? But it's not fast enough today now. And so under sustainability for a global society, you've got to go back to a carbon neutral society. You know how impossible that is? They never talk about the forest fires or volcanoes. You know how many volcanoes are off right now across the parts of the Pacific? All the way into basically just north of Japan even. There's one or two on the go right now. There's earthquakes going on. And those stuff is polluting the sky. Like you can see it from the satellites. But they never mention that, does he? The people who are petrified of it never mention that. Isn't that weird, eh? But pollution and carbon, eh? That's holy smoke, isn't it? From the god Volcanus, eh? Vulcan. But anyway, when you don't have consistency of rationale, there's something else on the go. You breathing is terrible, apparently. Even though carbon dioxide is a trace gas, which is essential for plants to thrive on to create oxygen. There you go. A trace gas. Most of greenhouse gas is actually water moisture. We call it humidity. But facts got nothing to do with a big agenda to reduce the population of the world. That's what it's always been about. Very openly, as I say, from the 1800s onwards, and then hushed up after World War II and reinvented again to get us all on board with it. We might object if they ask for you to just willingly die to save the planet. Eh? So we bring it about in a different way, and we'll all have to change how we live. And how you're going to change is reducing energy, including food. Food is an energy source, and the type of food too, folks. As I say, we didn't get to live a bit longer in this day and age by living in mud and wattle, what they call mud wattle huts, in dampness and in cold in the winter. That's not how we got to live a bit longer. Think about it, folks. Think about it. That's all I say, is think about it. And for the people who did warn us, going up to the year 2000 and beyond, we are going through it all. People get caught up in the immediacy of today's meme, which is to terrify you. And they forget about yesterday's meme and so on until they lose track of the big agenda. You find everything falls in place with the big agenda, folks. And don't just panic each time you hear the next scary story. That's control, isn't it? Anyway, I didn't even mean to go all this tangent to this week, but I'll put some links up for you to follow. For those who want to do it, I'm not going to put all the ones up on the latest barrage on sustainability and how you've got to live this way and got to live that way and cut back this and cut back that and be run by experts, you see. Your new priesthoods, if God is dead, well, here's your new white coat characters, the experts, you see. They're your high priests, they're gods actually, some of them. So they claim themselves. And Nietzsche would certainly be proud of them. And so would the gods of the mind, psychology, as they call it, behaviorism, to manage us so perfectly into this path without most folk even recognizing what's going on. There you go. Anyway, as I said, I didn't mean to go off on this tangent, but I thought I might as well, rather than just parrot the news to you. Because the news really is so weaponized. And you don't get dissenting voices pretty well loud anymore. And it's going to get worse. It's going to get worse as we go through it all. We have our nudge experts. I've given talks on them. They're international. And they prod you to behave on the internet and so on, or they'll cut you off. And they're active and at it. They're going to teach you, whether you like it or not, to self-police. Don't do this, don't do that, don't say this, don't say that. And just like Bertrand Russell said in the socialistic gulag we're in, basically, this world gulag, which they're creating this electronic gulag. Russell said they'll cut off your funding, your money, your credits, whatever they want to call it, from the state. Until you're on your knees and you can't pay your rent or feed yourself until you behave. And that is happening. We're living through this, folks. And that's not coincidence. Because the characters in Russell's day helped plan the whole system up to the present time. Including what Russell talked about, the true language of numbers. Which is, of course, is what they run your electronic systems by. Listen to it. You've got to realize you're in an incredible agenda. Anyway, for myself, Alan Waterman here in Canada, where the bugs are doing well. There's no shortage of them. And they certainly get fed well enough, feasting like outside. They swoop in there and I donate all the time to wildlife. Every year I do that, until I'm white as a sheep, of course. But that's just the way it is. For myself, Alan Waterman, to your Canada's good night to me, your God, or your God's go with you.